Good morning, WNF listeners. This is Jason Marlowe. I'm here, happy to be here on a Tuesday morning. Want to give a big shout out to Sean, who is letting me take over for the day. I am thrilled to be here with school board member Jessica Vaughn. Jessica, please say hello to everybody out there.
Hello. Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to be here.
That was a great hello. So thank you to everybody who's listening. We're here to talk really everything education that's going on right now. For those of our listeners who might not be aware, there are major decisions being made here in Hillsborough County about the future of Hillsborough County, and they're happening right now, and you guys, you know, the listeners are going to have the opportunity to make decisions on this in the future. And I guess let's sort of first start with what I would say is the most recent elephant in the room, and that's last Wednesday's vote on the community investment tax. Just briefly for our listeners, the first CIT was passed in 1996. It included major investments in infrastructure, in Raymond James Stadium, and in our schools. 25% of those dollars were invested in our schools. What the county commission, under a Republican majority, voted 5-2 to approve on Wednesday will be a 15-year tax as opposed to a 30-year tax. And as opposed to 25% of the CIT, it will be a lowly 5%. And why I think that's so significant, as we'll get into with school board member Vaughn here, is the school board made it clear that the minimum requirement for infrastructural expenses that they have is for 6.5% of the CIT dollars. These are new schools that are going to be built mostly in Republican County Commissioner Michael Owens, God, that's a Freudian slip, district. And he was one of the leaders on making sure that this money was not there. And so I wanted to pose this to you, school board member Vaughn. Please take a moment to introduce yourself. Sort of, what are the consequences of this on the school board and on our school system locally?
Thank you. Again, I really appreciate this opportunity. So yeah, my name is Jessica Vaughn. I'm the school board member for District 3, which is mostly in North Hillsborough, and also currently the vice chair of the Hillsborough County School Board. For anyone who follows, development in our county in general, so much of our development is in South County, as you mentioned, with Commissioner Owens' district. And we are struggling to keep up with placing the infrastructure and being able to put schools in that district. And so much of what we've been able to do in that district, in that area, has come directly from the previous CIT tax. So just like all the other ways we're being underfunded, this is definitely going to cause an issue when it comes to funding and figuring out how to manage the growth and support our students in those areas and our families. So I'm glad we got something, because it could have been nothing.
Yeah,
so
certainly.
I'm trying to look at the bright side, but I'm incredibly disappointed that, our superintendent went to really advocate and talk about the bare minimum. I was hoping, at the very least 10%, the fact that, he was able to understand how at 6.2%, I think that's what was quoted, we'd be able to manage the growth. And now to even have that be underfunded it's just concerning. It makes my job harder and more stressful.
And I mean, I'll say it's going to make the lives of parents in those communities harder and more stressful, as their kids will be in packed classrooms. And, Republicans in this state, if they have, one hobby, it's underfunding and public education. Mm-hmm. And the consequences of this, the funny thing that I see is there's something so incongruous with Michael Owen leading the charge on expanding the urban service corridor, which is going to flood these communities of Ruskin and Sun City with a lot more density and development than have existed previously. And then simultaneously, we're going to underfund the school construction. And, as you mentioned, Superintendent Van Ayer, he basically he's quoted here in the Times as saying, quote, "We were hoping to get to that 10%, hopefully 10% over 15 years. So, I mean, the fact that not only are they not getting 10, they're not getting the 6.2, they're getting 5. Commissioner Myers, my old boss, big shout out to my work mom. She made a motion to try to get this to the number that was necessary, and the board would not even entertain the motion. And like you said, I just tell people who don't really understand, as that urban service corridor gets expanded, as these communities start to grow and we don't have the school capacity to meet, classroom expectations, what are the consequences going to be on the average family and parent out in those communities?
Well, that's a good question, because it's not only going to affect that community. I mean, that's where a lot of our growth is. But if we have to allocate resources from other communities to manage that growth because we don't have that revenue source right now, it's going to affect everybody in Hillsborough County, every single school that has a capital outlay request. So to try to break it down a little bit, because school funding is very, very confusing, we have lots of budgets, but our two main budgets are operating expenses, which pays a majority of our salaries. And that's what you hear a lot of conversation around, especially when we come to negotiations about teacher and employee raises. And then we have our capital outlay budget, which is for all the physical stuff that comes into schools, air conditionings that we've heard so much about, painting, building schools. That's all the capital outlay budget. And so, you know, we've had an additional sales tax levy that we've been able to do amazing things, start to look at all those air conditionings, because our schools were built so long ago and they always need constant maintenance.
There you go. Gracious. You got it.
And so, you know, obviously if we can't build schools in the areas that we need to, exactly what you said, there's going to be overcrowding. Teachers are going to be frustrated. They're already frustrated as it is right now. We're looking at a mass exodus. And generally when I go into my schools and I talk to my teachers, it's based on two things. One, a livable wage, right? And that's a whole other conversation when we get to the other millage tax.
And we will get to that.
And then two, it's just the amount of workload, right? There's not enough people in our schools as it is. Classrooms, like you said, are overcrowded. There's a huge difference as a teacher being able to meet the needs, differentiate, make sure you're following the IEP, everything that you need to for 16 kids compared to 25
kids.
Oh
yeah. I mean, I was literally going to, you took the words literally right out of my mouth as someone who, you know, taught high school for 3 years myself. Like, I don't think people who maybe haven't been in a classroom can appreciate how big the difference is between if you have 22 kids and you have 30.
Yeah, but again, you have to look at each student's learning level and make sure that you're giving them rigor or you're pushing in where they need extra support. It's a lot of preparation. And then on top of that, you know, one of the things that we have to honor is school choice. And we're competing with so many charter schools, homeschools now, that if we can't, you know, allow parents to choose to go into certain schools because they're at capacity, we're going to lose those students to private schools or charter schools. And again, that all hurts our system. So it's, you know, it's like a cycle.
No, yeah. I mean, that's all connected, interconnected sort of with this, you know, a cruel and systemic underfunding of public education. You know, they have gutted the system to the point now where, I mean, listen, if I'm not a parent, but if I had a child and I was living in a school, in an area that was going to send my kid to a, you know, so let's say a substandard school, a school C or below, let's say, I don't think I could say in good conscience, no, you can't send your child to a better school with the idea of them trying to pursue a better future. I mean, like, you know, as we've discussed in our limited time, even before we got on, education really is like that great equalizer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'd be hard pressed to tell somebody like you can't send your kid to a better school. You know, every parent, you would assume, right, wants the best for their child.
Absolutely.
And, you know, we should be trying to allow parents to pursue the best pathway to success for their child. But it's also really difficult to do when public schools are the answer for the vast majority of Florida's children, and our state criminally consistently underfunds them to the point where, like you said, you know, we're having major exoduses to charter, you know, and other private schools. I mean, I remember what it was just last year, I think, or 2 years ago, you had a very contentious vote on the board about closing some charter schools that had not met, I guess, some merit.
Public schools, not charter schools.
Oh, yes. Thank you. I forgot.
No worries.
But can you talk about how that sort of ties into what we're talking about with, you know, this, you know, with the millage increase, with the CIT?
Absolutely. And, you know, I just want to kind of go back to something that you said, because in general, I don't believe, unfortunately, that standardized tests are a great indicator of a school's success, you know, especially when you look at some of the challenges around our ELL population. But however, every parent should be able to advocate for the right environment for their student, the school that's going to allow their student to have the absolute most success. Sometimes that just means location, right? If a school's within walking distance and you have access to it. So there's so many factors that allow for student success. Every parent should have the right to be able to find a school that matches their student's needs. But as you mentioned, as far as the criminal defunding and what was your exact question?
Just sort of like, how does that defunding correlate with your need for CIT dollars for the millage increase?
And so what happens is, as we have so many options oversaturating our community, we have so many charter schools, we start to lose students. And all of our funding goes into the same pot, you know, and then we allocate it out based on the need of each school. So if we have schools that are completely understaffed, we don't have enough students to justify keeping that school open, we have to make hard decisions. I did not vote to close the school, but I understand that it was a really hard decision, and my fellow board members first felt like that's what we needed to do. But now that's causing all sorts of chaos because so many families that had access to that school conveniently that could walk there or needed that now have to scramble to find other schools and figure out what transportation looks like. And that causes chaos and it disrupts the kids who, you know, got used to a certain environment. It's not good for our students to close schools and move them around.
And I imagine it's also probably challenging for another group of staff that doesn't really get, you know, the kind of the unsung heroes is the school board, you know, the bus drivers. I mean, I think a friend, Kevin O'Hare, at one point told me that I guess if you look at the numbers, Hillsborough County Public Schools transports more people mm-hmm. every day than any other entity, perhaps even in the whole region. I mean, you know, certainly more than HART or, you know, PTSA. And you think about that, you think about, you know, we're not paying these bus drivers. We're losing them. You guys have a shortage in that area as well, if I'm not mistaken.
Absolutely. Yeah, and it's not just the volume of people that we're transporting. It's our kids. It's our children.
Precious.
You know, our most precious cargo. And unfortunately, I mean, and we'll get into this because of the underfunding and operations and, I mean, and our general fund and what that looks like. You know, we're struggling to be able to compete with Amazon and other driving companies that are able to offer a higher wage. And, you know, we have benefits, but a lot of times when you're a bus driver and you're trying to put food on the table right now, you're going to pick a higher wage over long-term benefits because you've got a family to feed. And so we have to make sure that as the number one biggest employer in the entire county and, you know, the employer that's responsible for our children's future, that we're able to pay and recruit and keep the best, most talented bus drivers, teachers, paras, ESE teachers, cafeteria workers. Like our schools need to be the best. So I really hope our community sees value in that and is able to help us invest in that.
Yeah, well, so let's sort of use that to sort of piggyback talking about the proposed millage increase. And I mean, like, I do find it funny. If I recall, I did the math on this. According to what the Times said, using, this is a quote here, using the median home price of $306,000 as an example, after your homestead exemption is deducted, it would work out to about 75 cents a day. So doing that math, that's at 75 cents a day, even it's $273.75. Now, I'm not going to say to a family that's struggling that that's an insignificant amount,
for sure.
At the same time, if you are a parent and you're struggling, I think it would be pretty wise to see that $273 as an investment specifically in your child or your children. And it's like, it's not a, that's really not a lot of money over the year. That's less money than Sarah McLachlan asks you for in that commercial, you know, when they're like arms and the angel in the background. Like, that's less, like $273.75. We're not asking a whole lot of you to support the future of education in this county.
I thought that reference was really funny. I mean, listen, I agree with you. This is an incredibly hard time, especially when we talk about so many of our people on fixed income to come back for homeowners or people who are going to be renting that might see an increase and ask for more money. I mean, that is the last thing that myself and my fellow board members in our district want to do. However, we have to be realistic, as you've mentioned repeatedly, about the effects of the criminal defunding of public education and the attempt to privatize and what that means for our community. And we have to be able to pay our teachers a livable wage and our employees. And I don't know about the per cents per day, but I do know a quick calculation is, after you mentioned, after a homestead exemption, for every $1,000 that your home is worth, it's $1. Now, again, for me, that probably comes to about, you know, $400 or $500, like you mentioned as well. And when you look at car insurance, homeowners insurance, every little bit driving it up, it does become, you know, can I afford this? However, when I look at all the rising prices, for me, investing in public education and investing in our children and investing in our future and the people who take care of our children every single day is the most valuable thing to me, which is why I do what I do. So,
and listen, I'll say for whatever it's worth, you know, if you're living in a, you know, an apartment or a condo or a townhome, you're not going to be really eating it on this tax. If you are living on Ballast Point and you probably can afford it, yeah, you'll have to pay a little bit more because you live in a $1.75 million mansion on the water. Like, I think you'll be okay. Like, the funny, it is a tax that seems to, like, appropriately, you know, tax everybody at an equal representative amount.
Right.
You know, it's not overtaxing people who don't have money and undertaxing people who do have it. It's appropriately taxing everybody in a way that everybody benefits from.
And I think that what gets lost in a lot of conversation is we're not the only county who has to do this.
Pasco, Pinellas.
Almost every single county around us, except for Hernando, I believe, and every single county, our scope and size, right? When we're talking about the size of how many schools we have and how many students we service, unfortunately, throughout the years, have had to go out and ask for this tax. And I mean, some of them are extremely rural districts, some of them are urban districts, and there has not been, other than Hillsborough County, one county this has not passed in.
And I mean, our county, like you mentioned it sort of, you know, ostensibly, the challenges that we face because we're an urban county and a rural mm-hmm. county, and we're a county of 1.4 million people.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, if I recall, we are the, what's the size? We're
the,
one of
seventh
the largest
country.
School district in the United
country.
States.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I don't think people have an appreciation or understanding of the scope and scale of that. I mean, like, when we're talking about needing these investments, it's not because, you know, like, this is some small hodgepodge entity. We're really trying to, like, make the whole county run here.
Absolutely. And, you know, our district touches almost everyone in Hillsborough County, whether you have a child in our schools, whether you have a grandchild in our schools, most people have someone who's employed in our school district. Again, as I've mentioned, it's the biggest employer in the entire county. And so for just that mere fact of, like, this touches me in some way and touches my life, I hope people can rally for this and, you know, see the value in it and come out and vote for it and make sure that we have what we need to be competitive. Because even if we are able to raise salaries based on our own internal budget, the counties that have this are always going to be able to offer more. And I live in North Hillsborough, right? I live probably 15 minutes from the Pasco border. So it's really easy for teachers who live out where
to just hop across.
Drive 15 minutes more, you know, to be able to make $5,000 or $6,000 a year. And I don't begrudge them that. Again, you know, we're talking about inflation and livable wages and how hard it is. I mean, I don't begrudge anybody for making a choice to be able to offer healthcare or feed their families or do whatever they need to. And so we have to, as Hillsborough County, the seventh largest district, something where our school district touches almost everybody who lives in this county, we have to be competitive and be able to offer our kids, our students, the best education possible. And I will always fight for that.
So, like, let me, not that I believe, but let me play devil's advocate mildly. You know, the tax did fail in 2022. And so I would sort of say, you know, obviously, and the board was split on this in a 5-2 vote. So, you know, let's say to a, you know, a Republican in Waimama mm-hmm. or, you know, an independent in Oldsmar, what would, I guess, your particular pitch be to them, you know, whether they have kids or not, as to why this tax merits their vote more so perhaps than the 2022 ballot referendum?
Well, thank you for asking.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, you know, I think that public education, in my experience, is a nonpartisan issue. And I find it unfortunate that it's been divided between different parties. I have Republicans, nonpartisan, Democrats on all ends of the spectrum who absolutely value traditional public education, want to fight for it. You know, let's be honest. People want to be able to move into a neighborhood where they feel comfortable and go to a school where they feel like their kids are going to be supported and not have to worry about navigating charter schools and finding transportation and getting on a wait list and being on a lottery and figuring out if the siblings are going to go together, right? They just want to be able to move into a neighborhood where they feel like they're part of the community and send their kids to good schools. I do feel like with the last referendum, it was unfortunate timing. I think that, you know, we had a superintendent that wasn't...
Oh, he's gone now. Say it. Say it, girl.
I mean, he wasn't the most popular superintendent. I think people had concerns about his leadership. I mean, I worked very well with Addison Davis, but that's what I'm hearing in my schools. I also think we are at the point where, you know, we weren't necessarily negotiating with our employees that we had. And so I think that our employees felt like this was a direct correlation to getting the promised raises that they were asking for, you know, that in order to even get what they were already earned, they had to vote for this. And I don't think anybody wants to feel that way. You know, we've been very successful since then negotiating outside of this millage. You know, we're still going to continue to negotiate and use all of our resources to pay our educators and our employees what they're worth, but we have to be competitive. If there's an extra bonus that we can offer because Pinellas can offer it or Pasco can offer it, we have to. So I would say, you know, I know that Republicans value public education, and I know that, you know, it only failed by less than 500 votes last time, or less than 600, I think 595. And so when I go into my schools and I talk to the people who work in my schools, and I'm in my schools all the time, I see a difference in the behavior and the response to this. People know now, they've seen other counties, they realize how much we need it. They see how overcrowded our schools are and we need more employees. They know how hard it is to get a competitive wage. And I feel probably too optimistic about it. So, and if people have questions or concerns, listen, I'm always accessible. My fellow board members are accessible. I want to be able to answer people's questions. So if there's a Republican who wants to have access and ask some questions, you know, I can give my number out of the
room. No, we're going to do one better. You know, to the listeners out there, you're speaking of accessibility. If you do want to get involved in this conversation, we'd love to have you be present. You can call us in at 813-239-9663. Again, that's 813-239-9663. I'm Jason Marlowe. I'm here with school board member Jessica Vaughn, and we are really talking all things education. So building on that to a little bit, because I do find this interesting. So I want to sort of tell me sort of what could the county do if this passes? And I also sort of want to hear like the dire, like what do you think the consequences would be if this ballot referendum fails? Because I imagine if it fails in 2024, I can't see the county going for another bite at the apple in 2026. And so it's like, what are, you know, what can you do with the money if it's passed?
Yeah.
And what are the consequences of it if it fails?
So for, I believe, 89% of it, that's going directly for employee salaries. So what the superintendent has proposed, and it's always open for negotiations with our union, but what the superintendent is proposing is a straight $6,000 across the board for teachers and administrators, and then $3,000 added for support staff. And so that right there is a pretty clear number of people knowing what they're going to be able to get and be able to budget and what that looks like. Now, some of the questions we've gotten is that money sustainable? You know, because this is only a 4-year millage. We'll have to go back out in 4 years. If it doesn't pass, do our employees still get that differential? The answer is going to be no, right? So every single employee is going to have something on their paycheck that talks about the addition, a line item that they can see directly comes from this millage, and it won't be there if we don't pass it again in 4 years. So, you know, our employees can expect something pretty substantial. I mean, I have a ton of teacher friends. $6,000, especially for my teacher friends that there's dual teachers in the relationship, $12,000 more, that's a game changer for a lot of our employees and allows them to stay in our county or even stay in just being teaching. So again, I think it comes down to retaining and being able to keep great, qualified, passionate educators, your favorite teacher in the classroom for your kid or your nephew or what's so important. If we don't have it, I mean, I'm going to be honest because that's the way way that I roll, right? For good or bad, people like it or they don't like it. We're going to continue to bleed our employees to surrounding districts. We're going to lose great teachers. And aside from losing the teachers of the other employees, and there's a whole slew of other employees I'm not even talking about that don't get enough recognition, right? Again, the cafeteria workers who make a kid's day by serving the right pizza and can change, you know, their entire day to be ready to learn, or our janitorial staff that clean up so much, or, you know, our nurses in our, I mean, if counselors, it goes on and on and on. But not only are we going to lose teachers, the workload becomes immeasurable. Every employee who leaves, somebody has to pick up that slack. There's another employee that has to work twice as hard, and our employees are burning out. I mean, coming through the pandemic, the chaos that we saw, the extra work, jumping through hoops, going virtual, doing hybrid classes, trying to learn new technology. It's been an exhausting few years for people in education, and asking them to do more work because we can't pay competitive wages, it's a recipe for disaster when you talk about education.
So, like, can you offer, like, to listeners, like, maybe like an anecdote or like an experience in your time as school board where teacher absenteeism or teachers leaving the system, you've been able to see, you know, obviously, unfortunately, but see the tangible negative consequences on a school of quality staff leaving?
I mean, every single day.
God, that's depressing.
Every single day when I go into schools, every single employee that I talk to, when I say, because I stop, I introduce myself. I always thank employees for the work that they do. And I say, how can the district better support you? What can we do? And it always comes down to, can you pay us a little bit more? Always, jeez, right? And then I just need more help. We need another person in this position. We need another teacher. We have a substitute teacher who's teaching third grade, you know, and I have to make sure that I'm doing the parent-teacher conferences. Or, I mean, it's pervasive. I can't say it's in low-income schools, high-income schools, rural schools, urban schools. And my district has all of those. It's pretty expansive. It is in every single school I go to. And I say it from the dais, and I ask the superintendent when we pass this millage, will this address the two top biggest concerns that I have from every single employees when I go into my school? And he said yes. And I mean, let's be honest, our employees are amazing. I mean, it's redundant to say, but not many people go into education trying to be rich, right? We always say that.
No one goes in education. As two public, like neither of us thought we were ever going to get rich doing this.
But that doesn't mean that our employees don't deserve a livable wage. I mean, again, yeah, we're not talking about, you know, extreme wealth. We're talking about being able to pay their car insurance or put food on the table. I mean, we have employees who are utilizing food banks. We have employees who are sleeping in their cars, you know. If I talk about it too much, I'll get upset. But
no, I mean, it's inexcusable. I mean, you think about the fact that, you know, when you put in that amount of effort on behalf of other people's children to be put in that position where you're having to make extremely, extremely difficult choices, not because you are not working, you're actually working on behalf of, you know, other people's children. I mean, it's really shocking to know how many people who I knew in my limited experience who were teachers who, you know, they put off having a family. They put off getting married. They weren't able to buy a home. They're, you know, they rent. Like, the consequences of that long term over, you know, them as a family, them as a couple, it's the ripple effects are really, really huge. And, you know, when we talk about 473 current teacher vacancies, mm-hmm, I mean, it's hard to fathom what that sounds like come August 2026, mm-hmm, in the absence of this increase. I mean, like, It's a very, very scary proposition because, you know, I, having listened to the conversations at the county commission over the course of the CIT, basically part of the reason it sounded like why they wanted to, if not completely cut the schools, minimize their funding was as a result of the school board voting to take upon this tax before the voters. And I think we can do both things at the same time. And I fail to understand why we're not just embracing the reality that if we want things to be of high quality in this county, we're going to have to pay for them.
Yeah, and a lot of people are confused about the funding. Again, the CIT tax is our capital outlay. That's a different funding bucket, right, to kind of paint a visual picture, than the operating expenses. And we're underfunded in both. Right? So they're not really comparable, but I understand. I will say that I've heard, and I don't know if it's true, that just having education in the last CIT tax is really kind of what pushed it over into the voters' realm of passing it. Because I do think that most people value education. I mean, it's the biggest equalizer, right? It's the foundation of the American dream and the dream of democracy, right? Equal access to education. I talk to, you know, people who come from other countries, and just trying to get education depends on what class you're in.
Yeah.
And I mean, the truth is, you know, when we talk about our teacher vacancies, it hurts our marginalized communities the most, right? That's where we see a huge number of vacancies. And those are our kids that have the least amount of support generally coming into school and need those great teachers and need the extra support and the reading coaches and the success coaches that we have to provide them to equal that playing field so that they can be successful. And while, you know, you might think, well, that doesn't really affect me, I don't live in a marginalized community. I mean, as you mentioned when we were kind of talking before the show, absolutely. I mean, we want all of our citizens to be able to make the best, to have the best education, to make the best job. I mean, we're all connected. And so raising up any marginalized community only makes us as a whole better, right? We can't disconnect ourselves from our neighbor and be like, that doesn't affect me.
No, absolutely. I mean, I don't want to hear folks in Ballas Point or Hyde Park talk about how they don't like crime in Tampa and then subsequently deny children educational opportunities that allow them to see a different future for themselves.
Right.
I mean, like, those things are connected. I do feel like there's this weird but kind of linear thread between you underfund public education and you end up having to do, like you said, make a controversial choice between closing JUST or not closing JUST,
right?
Because you underfund public education to the point where now all these teachers are leaving. They don't want to work in these marginalized schools. And now here, Hillsborough County Public Schools is being asked to make an extremely difficult choice between, do we close the community school because it's potentially failing its children and parents, or do we have to find some way to like reimagine it? And obviously you guys have come to that conclusion, which I think is fantastic, but the reason why you guys had to even get to that choice is because Tallahassee and local, you know, Republicans have basically seen fit to put you guys in those kind of difficult positions.
For sure. I mean, at this point, I mean, it started years ago, I think 20, 25 years ago with No Child Left Behind, but the mission in Florida has been the most aggressive when it comes to privatizing education.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thought process between starving out schools so that we're underfunded, there's the culture wars now, which are causing so much amount of chaos. You know, it all leads to people thinking that public education isn't great and it's been a failure and it's easy to quickly privatize that. And again, you know, who does that hurt? You know, it hurts the people who have the least amount of access to jumping to all these school choices. I mean, my kid's going to be fine. You know, I can give him all the support that he needs, but it's going to be people who don't have access to transportation, who don't understand navigating a school choice on a website, who, you know, didn't get in the lottery in time. It's going to be, you know, our most marginalized community members who are hurt the most. And what does that say to our society, you know, when we don't care about our kids who have less support? So.
Yeah, I mean, listen, in times where everybody's facing that economic crunch, whether it be inflation or one thing, everything we can be doing to try to offer people, you know, opportunities, you know, to educationally improve themselves, seek better futures, we should be doing, because, you know,
that's
times,
the American dream.
Times are hard. I mean, like the reality, I think, out there, bizarrely enough, is despite the fact that the economic numbers look very, very good on a national level, I think despite those numbers, a lot of people you talk to, they're not feeling that connection. They're not feeling the economy necessarily thriving or growing around them, particularly because their costs are increasing. And I mean, that sort of connects to the millage increasing. Obviously, we talked about, you know, homeowners feeling that hit, mm-hmm. albeit minor.
Yeah.
But I think we talked a little bit about what the consequences would be at the schools. Can you sort of say, like, so vision with me, like 4 years from now, all right, it's 2028. What can we do if we have this money? Like, you know, are we going to be able to offer, like, do you feel confident we can retain the quality staff with that $6,000 raise? Like, is that enough?
I do. I mean, you're talking to the wrong person. I'm a huge, huge supporter of educators and our employees making as much as possible because I'm passionate about education. I'll put it like this. You know, I'm rerunning for re-election. It was a tough decision for me to make that decision, but I'm committed to it. The thing that keeps me up at night, that makes it so challenging, is if I win a re-election and this millage doesn't pass, the 4 years subsequent to that, the heartbreaking, hard decisions that we're going to have to make and what that's going to look like.
Look like layoffs, potentially?
I mean, potentially it could lead anywhere, right? I mean, I wouldn't think so. I mean, with the kind of vacancies that we have, but, you know, I don't think it will lead to layoffs. It's hard to say. You never know what's going to happen. I just think it's going to lead to people voluntarily leaving. And, you know, when I could pull up emails right now of employees that I have that are asking for just basic help, that are literally sending us their bills, right? Like, here's what I make every 2 weeks. Here's what my mortgage is. Here's what my car payment is. Here's what my child care is. I have $20 left over at the end of the week to pay for all these additional things. Please help me. And the idea of, again, the next 4 years watching and not being able to, you know, say, yes, we can pay a competitive wage and get those emails and the decisions we're going to make, again, that's what really keeps me up at night.
Yeah, I have such empathy. I mean, as someone who was a public school teacher, you know, I left for, you know, as so many others did, whether it be, you know, the lack of pay or the frustrations with administration or, as you mentioned, testing. I mean, if we can a little bit, let's switch gears mildly into that, because I do think there's something that worthy of discussion there. You mentioned schools are not necessarily, their grades and their test scores are not necessarily a quality indicator of the quality of that school.
Absolutely.
And I wanted to see if you might be able to like elaborate a little bit on that and sort of elucidate to our listeners like what exactly we mean by that.
Sure. So our school grades are based solely on standardized testing. And standardized testing is never a great indication of a kid's actual gains or the progress that they're making or, you know, other than proficiency. Like, I'll give you an example. At one of my schools recently, I was touring it and we walked into the library and one of the teachers was having like a Socratic circle with the students who had not done as well on the standardized test this last time that they had the time before that. There had been some drops and they were kind of trying to figure out what that looked like. And every single time it was like the student was having a bad day. They had a fight with their friend. They had something going on at home. You can have a bad day where you test poorly, and that's not an indication of what your true measurements are. Then we're going into the new testing, which is adaptive, and that's got its own problems as it is because it's not broken down per category. Let's say, I'll give you an example. Let's say you're taking a math test and you're really great at area, but you're not good at fractions. And you start off with fractions and you're answering at lower levels. It's going to continue to feed you lower level questions throughout the entire test, even when you get to that area or dimensions that you're great at, and you're never going to have the chance to answer those high level questions because you started off with a subject you're not good at. On top of that, you know, we're talking about kids that come in that have almost no support, right? And on top of that, we're looking at our ELL population. Yeah. I mean,
English is not a first language.
It's only a 2-year mark that they give our students who don't come in speaking English as a native as their main language. 2 years to be proficient on a test. It takes way longer than that
to learn language acquisition.
So if you have a school that has a high ELL population,
their numbers are just gonna,
and they're being held to accountability after 2 years, which is unrealistic. There are so many factors that are against so many communities that to me, it's just not a good measurement of student progress.
No, actually, so we actually have a caller. I'm going to patch this person in. Caller, please identify yourself.
Is it me?
It is you.
Swearingen?
It is you. You are on the air, ma'am. How can we, what, do you have a question or a comment for a school board member, Vaughn?
I have a comment. I'm totally pro public schools. I went to public schools and had really good schools, but I'm also a homeowner in Seminole Heights and I bought my house in the last 10 years. My property taxes are almost $11,000 now, and I'm on Social Security. I'm not going to be able to afford to live in my house if they go up any higher. And I just think that owning a home is also a part of the American dream. And I don't think anybody has the money, and I wish there was another way to get this money. If we could, I mean, a higher sales tax where it hit everybody, or why can't some of the money we spend letting DeSantis do whatever he wants to do, why can't we just put more money towards the school? You know, I will vote no, and I feel bad for schools, and I feel bad for the teachers, but teachers are leaving Florida for other reasons than pay. Too. You know, they're not being allowed to teach the truth here. I have friends who are teaching in California now and say it's like night and day with, you know, the diversity and equality and the things they can actually talk about that they can't hear. So that's my comment, just that I'm not going to be able to afford to live in my home if my property taxes go up any higher.
Well, one, I appreciate the call. Two, I completely empathize. And, you know, I respect, I mean, just like our teachers, you're in a position where you have to make the best decisions for your own life. And I completely understand that. And I don't disagree with you. I would much rather our state legislation, our Republican controlled state legislation, and our governor fully fund, you know, public education like our state statute asks them to. So I don't disagree with you. And as far as being able to teach and teachers leaving and the culture wars, I mean, I hope we reserve some time for that because we do have some book challenges coming up and I'd like to talk about that. However, if you cannot vote for this tax, what I would urge you to do is contact your legislators every session. We just ended session. Mm-hmm. There were several things on our platform that we advocated for as a school board that would have allowed more funding and more flexibility with our funding. I would you know, just urge you, if you can't support this tax and you support public education, please be in touch with every single one of your legislators, and not even just your legislators. I mean, I encourage people who support public education to make it a single voting issue like other ones, and ask everybody running for office from soil and water all the way up to the governor where they stand and if they're going to fund public education. But I urge you, I go to Tallahassee every single year to advocate for our legislative platform, and I get told by legislators, we don't hear this from our voters. No one's contacted me about this. I don't get this feedback. They're all listed online. You can find them easy. And again, I urge you, if this is something you can't support, please fight for public education in other ways and demand that our state funds it adequately.
Yes, yes. And I'll vote for people who believe in public education and who would put money that we're already paying towards things that will help our kids and help our society.
And I'm glad you bring that up, because a lot of people wonder, well, gosh, you know, my property taxes have gone up so much. And we did a really great presentation about this, you know, during when we passed the millage on to voters to make this decision. Because I want to be clear, the school board did not vote to implement this tax. We simply passed it to the voters to make this decision, like you're empowered to do yourself, is that the state caps the amount of revenue that we can get from homeowners' taxes. So we are student rich and property poor, and we always have been. And so the state takes all of the property taxes and they put it in one big bucket, and then they see which counties have collected more, and they take that away and they equalize it in the amount per student that they give us. So taxes could go up, and as far as our operating expenses is where we pay our teacher salaries, we have a cap on that. So it doesn't go up exponentially for us. Our revenue isn't just, you know, open to property taxes. And a lot of people don't understand that, because all of this is complicated by design.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I know the difference is, according to when you bought your home, my neighbors pay about $4,000. I pay $11,000.
Wow.
My sister pays $700.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah.
I feel bad, but that, you know, it's a real issue for me, because I'm so happy to finally be able to buy a home and to live here.
Yeah.
And, it may not last.
No, listen, thank you so much for calling, ma'am. We really appreciate your thoughts. Thank you for taking your time.
Thank you.
You have a wonderful day, ma'am. So let's get into that. You wanted to talk a little bit about some of the book challenges and some other issues facing our kids and other things going on with our schools. So hit us.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, you know, as the caller mentioned, you know, absolutely. Number one, especially, you know, teachers and our employees, Day Micro Focus, our livable wages and having the supports that we need in our schools. But we can't discount how frustrating and confusing these culture wars have been in our schools and what kind of chaos that's, you know, led to. I mean, there's a lot of our employees who don't know exactly what they're allowed to say, what they're able to teach, you know, if they can offer an inclusive classroom, if they can put up a sticker that says everybody's welcome. You know, it's been very taxing, especially on our media center employees, you know, our media specialists. And so, you know, here in Hillsborough County, we've done an amazing job of being very, very focused on our procedures if there's a book challenge. And so if a book challenge comes in, let's say there's a citizen or a parent who's concerned about, you know, a book that we have in our libraries, because I want to be clear, we do not have any pornography in our Hillsborough County school libraries. You know, from the very definition of pornography, it means the writer's intent is for arousal. We don't have any books in our library that is pornography. Now, there are sexually explicit books for our high school students. There always have been. I don't know how many of us read Flowers in the Attic when we were growing up.
Kesher or and the Rye wasn't exactly tame.
Or, as some people have read passages, the Bible, right? I mean, anything taken out of context, you know, can be sexually explicit, can have incest, can have different things in it. But, however, if someone is concerned about the content, the sexually explicit content, they can challenge a book at the library. First, they contact the teacher or the principal. They give them the opportunity. The media specialist looks at it, sees if there's value, you know, does research on it. If they decide to keep the book, it then goes to a local school committee that is made up from the media specialist before the year even starts of people who live in that community. They read the book, they evaluate it, they vote whether they're going to keep it in their school or not. If they decide to keep it and the person who challenged the book is not happy, it goes to a district committee where everyone at the district reads the book. They have a long conversation about it. They talk and they vote. If they decide to keep it, it then comes before the school board where we talk about it.
So this is very Kafka-esque.
And then we have, you know, we vote. And if for whatever reason we decide to keep it, if the challenger is still unhappy, it goes to a magistrate who makes a decision at the state level. We've only had one book challenge previous to this in Hillsborough County. This book is gay, which we voted to remove from a middle school because it seemed more applicable for high school. We have two book challenges coming up on April 29th at 1 p.m. At the school board. It's called Blankets is one of them, and the other one is called Identical. One of them, Identical, is written in poetry prose, and it's about two sisters. And Blankets is about a young man who grew up in kind of a religious Christian cult and his challenges with that in a graphic novel form and how he persevered and found a relationship with God despite those conflicts. And so I've gotten a lot of feedback from students where these books have had a huge impact on them. But we do have a challenge coming up. And unfortunately, a lot of times we have people shipped in from out of county who say inflammatory things to kind of get people upset. But I can tell you that we had our last meeting and we had a lot of people who were talking about the book challenges and I got zero email from concerned parents.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, Moms for Ménage à Trois is not really as active as they used to be. So like, I do feel like there's been, you know, like, and I sort of feel like that whole movement has sort of seen itself sort of ebb and flow a little bit. And I think now we're sort of in the receding era of that, you know, the whole, you know, outreach on parental rights. I do think there has been sort of, people have seen enough of that and they're willing to now give control back to the folks who actually have some professional expertise in these arenas.
Well, the funny thing is when you remove access to things, you're actually limiting parental rights because anyone can at any point call any of our librarians and say, I don't want my kid to have access to these books. Please notify me. As an individual parent, you have full control over access. But when you remove these books from the library, you're actually limiting other parents' rights who may see value in their child reading these.
My parents took away the Slim Shady LP, but it did not stop me from listening to Eminem. So we have one more caller. We're going to patch them through.
Thank you.
All right. Good morning, caller. You are on the air.
Hey. Hello.
Hey.
When they passed all the scratch offs and the gambling stuff, wasn't a lot of that supposed to go to education? What happened to that money? And then one other thing is, when you got Rick Scott as senator and you got DeSantis and all these Republicans who want to destroy public education and send it to Christian schools, we're already in trouble. So I'll hang up and listen. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir, for calling in.
Yeah, so that's a great question, and we get that quite a bit because the lottery was sold on supporting public education. And for years and years, we did get a supplement from the lottery that we were able to use in our categoricals because a lot of people, you know, they see our $4.4 billion budget and they think, oh, that's so much money. But a lot of it is strictly lined item to a specific thing that we can spend it on. And a lot of times if we don't, the state sweeps the money back.
And so, I'll just say, piggybacking really quick for perspective, what's the county budget you said for Hillsborough County Public Schools?
$4.4 billion.
So Hillsborough County is 9.92. So to like put that in perspective, City of Tampa is 1.92.
Wow.
So like to give listeners some, I think, perspective in terms of the numbers, that's less than half of what Hillsborough County requires.
Yeah. Our kids get the least amount of funding per pupil. We're like 48th in the entire country. I mean, like Kentucky does a better job than we do. But to answer the caller specifically, the lottery money was no longer given to us starting in 2021. They actually took that money away from the categorical that we got it. So unfortunately, we do not have access to that money anymore. And that's what's been happening. I mean, it hasn't been like there's been one thing. It's been a slow erosion of funding categoricals, slowly to chip away at it. So, you know, and unfortunately, as a school board member, we get a lot of the brunt of that, right?
Yeah, do you have, like, so this is a silly question that I think I know the answer to, but I wonder if, you know, maybe all of our listeners do. Do you guys have, as a school board, any recourse when the state decides to come down on y'all and cut funding or pass some kind of arbitrary rule that makes the job of Hillsborough County Public Schools and their administrators harder? Do you guys have any active recourse outside of saying going to hire a lobbyist or having HCPS lobbyists go up to Tallahassee and work the same circuit that everybody else does?
No, and there have been a few times where we've tried to exercise that in the last few years. There were some charter schools we voted against that were quite concerning. Even at one point, we were just talking about possibly finding another superintendent, and the state sent very threatening, heavy-handed letters that threatened to take us over, quite honestly.
Manny Diaz. Yep.
Richard Corcoran before that. So.
Oh, God, what a delightful little duo.
So unfortunately, you know, or fortunately, we're beholden to the state. Some school boards are different. It depends on their charter. Some, you know, are actually held accountable to their county commission or their city council, but Hillsborough directly operates under the state.
It feels so awful that you guys had this $4-point-something billion budget. You have all of these issues. And in the end, you really don't have any recourse with which, outside of people voting and changing the dynamic of those who, you know, make decisions that you guys have to deal with,
yeah,
there's no recourse for you as a local school board member to fight whatever Tallahassee is bringing down. Because, I mean, you know, in an era of just never ending, you know, just overriding of local authority on everything.
Correct. Home rule.
Yeah, I mean, which is just a joke, I think, at this point.
Especially for education. I mean, in the attempt to privatize, they've been eroding home rule for so long, which is frustrating because my voters voted for me to represent their needs. And when I'm not able to do that, I mean, our state is so big and every district is so huge. Trying to make one size fits all rules for each district is really a disservice to the voters. And that's why we originally had home rule. So for me, you know, other than educating people, sometimes I think school boards are around just to be like the punching bag for the destruction of public education. They give us so little power to make actual decisions. However, you know, we do make policies, and I don't want to undermine the importance of school board members or school boards as an oversight committee. I mean, regardless of whether it's very structured and it's categorical, you know, we are the eyes and ears on a $4.4 billion budget, which I think is important. And if people watch school board meetings, we're very intentional about every single penny that we pay.
And I do feel like, you know, where there have been some contentious school boards in the past,
yeah,
like to the credit of all seven members on the school board currently, no, seriously, y'all seem to have really found a way to go along, to get along. The you know, mean girl era, which, you know, I think a lot of people had their issues with, is assuredly over, in the sense that, you know, there seems to be a pretty good deal. I don't want to say a camaraderie, but there's a lot of, having watched some of those meetings, yeah, you guys are willing to give and take and compromise and listen to one another. And you have a superintendent that I think has the confidence of all seven members.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'll say I was on a show with school board member Gray just a couple months ago after Van Ayer had been elected unanimously to become the new superintendent. While there's a lot of challenges on a state level, there's so much reason for optimism here locally,
sure,
because we have a school board that cares, that is active, that's engaged, that's not bickering, and you have a superintendent that knows the lay of the land, cares, and I think it has a lot of energy and enthusiasm to righting a lot of the wrongs.
I really appreciate that perspective and sharing it, because we've done a lot of work for that. And I do. I feel very lucky. I feel like, you know, at the very end of the day, every single member on that board is committing to public education and doing its right. We may have different opinions about what that looks like, but I feel really lucky. Like, there's no one on there trying to destroy or do anything for personal ambition. And I've been lucky to work with some really great colleagues. And I am hopeful about the future. We have great employees. I love Hillsborough County. We have a great superintendent. I'm really positive this passes, that our board kind of maintains what it is, and that, you know, we can go into the next phase doing everything we need to support every student. I mean, our motto is, you know, every student should succeed. Hillsborough strong. And I do feel positive about that. So thanks for sharing that perspective.
No, I mean, truly, you know, I do feel like there has been a perception based upon the last several school boards that the school board was rather dysfunctional. I know the Times was tagging y'all a lot when there were a lot of arguments over the budget over the last 2 years. And I'll say, having watched a little bit of the meetings over this last couple months, I'm personally rather encouraged by the current construction of the board. And I mean, like, you know, there are Republicans on that board, there are Democrats, but you guys find a way to get along, to work together, to listen to one another, to compromise. I think it bodes very, very well for us that we have a board that is functioning as one. I mean, whereas, you know, no disrespect to some of the other bodies in our county, you cannot say that about the county commission. You cannot say that about city council. But the school board, despite being, you know, a partisanly split, does seem to be, to some extent, of one mind on a lot of issues. I mean, we only have 5 minutes left, but I did want to see if we could take up briefly school board member Gray and the discussion on cell phone usage. Because as someone who is a, you know, we have literally 5 minutes remaining, but as someone who is a school teacher myself, like, we go to, all right, so we, all right. So suffice to say, like, we have like 30 seconds, but how do you feel about cell phones?
I think there should be some cell phone restrictions. I think they are a distraction for kids. You know, I think that teachers and parents agree they don't need access to them during instructional time unless given by the teacher. But I do think that they should have access in their backpack, or if they need to in the case of emergencies or need to contact their parent, they should have access to that. So I look forward to more conversation around that policy to see what that looks like. I appreciate you bringing that up.
Awesome, wasn't it? So I'm Jason Marlowe. I've had a wonderful discussion here with school board member Jessica Vaughn.
Thank you
so much, Jessica, for attending. As we roll out, you know, never forget that.